Welcome back to You Can With AI. I'm your host, Nathaniel Whittemore, also host of the AI Daily Brief, and today we're getting practical about what it really takes to make AI work inside complex enterprises. Not in a demo, but across the real systems, processes, data flows, and teams that run the business. Joining me are Danielle Beringer, Principal in Advisory Data Modernization at KPMG LLP, and Ellery Fisher, Senior Vice President and Chief Information Officer at McKesson Medical Surgical. Together, they bring both the modernization lens and the operator's lens to a conversation about where AI projects get stuck, why legacy systems matter more in the agentic era, and how companies can start turning big AI ambition into usable, measurable progress. All right, Danielle, Ellery, welcome back to You Can With AI. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, really great to be here. Thank you.
So I was just mentioning as we were getting prepped for this, this is a conversation, there are going to be lots of dimensions to it, but it's a conversation that is had in various versions in every single corporation, enterprise, company of any sort, and has been for the last few years. And I think it perhaps has turned a corner recently from a less sophisticated version of the conversation, let's say, to a more sophisticated version. And that's what we're here to talk about. Before we get into it, I would love for you guys to provide just a little bit of background to the listeners around the context that you're bringing professionally to this. And Danielle, maybe we'll start with you.
Sure. Thank you. So hey, everyone, I'm Danielle Beringer. I'm a partner in KPMG's data modernization practice. Spent a lot of time with our clients looking at what is the most contemporary data, AI, ML, and Gen AI architecture, looking at the strategy, the design, and the deployment. What are the implications for delivering value? And certainly multi-cloud, highly complex environments where people are starting to see the big difference between their transactional workloads and their application modernization, and ultimately what they want to do in their data analytics and AI deployment plan. It's great to be here. Thanks, Nathaniel, again, for having me.
And Ellery.
Thank you. Yes, I have the pleasure of leading technology for McKesson Medical Surgical. We are a large, highly diversified healthcare services business. If that sounds vague, it's because there are a lot of different things in there. If you've heard before, healthcare is complicated. And at the highest level, we view our mission to take the complexity out for providers, and that takes a lot of forms and shapes. And so it creates a ton of opportunity to navigate how intelligence can reduce complexity, can bring efficiency, economics, but also, you know, we're a 200-year-old company. Some of our technology reminds us of that. And so it's also a really interesting challenge to contend with. How do we take something that is a big, complex, legacy operating entity and guide it into this really new space where a bunch of new things are possible and frankly, very badly needed?
Awesome. Tons of experience to bring to the conversation. And so to kick us off, let's talk about the difference between AI being a data problem and AI being a systems problem. What is that difference at core? And why does it matter as we talk about how AI gets rolled out across the business world?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that data often was the core of where a lot of people focused as being an inhibitor, right, for successful traditional AI, ML, and Gen AI. Now, when we're seeing the modernization of a lot of these legacy systems, I think it's both, right? It's the data, it's the context, it's the process and the people that are all around the upgrading of the technology or the migration decisions that are being made. And I think we also see a scenario where 8 out of 10 applications that all have the same data gravity or have functional relevance to each other, there's still 2 left behind, you know, and how can now with the advent of low code, no code and code assistive tools, let's get those last 2 into the last mile so that they can join the 8 applications that have already been modernized. And I think there's this kind of, there's a gap that often happens with that. And so you don't have a fully fleshed agentic experience or completely new application because you've still got these old systems. Maybe it's old COBOL code, mainframe code, or a SaaS product that is not allowing full integration or modernization. So I think there's one leg in each camp. I think the data and data quality and data context and business engagement is still a huge part of effective modernization. But I do think there are sometimes some systems constraints that are very real.
I think those are all great points. I kind of think what's happening is like we collectively are understanding the issue better, and data was the thing right in front of us, right? Why is this not working? Well, because the data is poorly organized, poor quality, right? All the things we've been talking about for the last half decade. If you pull out a level, though, you kind of get to this, like, where does the data come from and why is the data crazy? And you realize the data reflects the systems that it is coming from, right? Like that data is being generated or processed through these systems that were really never built to work in concert and never imagined where we were going to try and orchestrate things with intelligence across the entire estate of a complex entity, you know, like a corporation. And then, you know, where you look to activate data, right? All right, we've got intelligence, we've used it to come to some intelligent conclusion, we've determined an action. How do we go create that action and then get signals to understand how well it worked and assess it? We're back to systems. And so I think we're just pulling out and seeing that on both sides of data, systems are the why and then the so what. I think the other part of it that is kind of really important to grasp as we look at this is that, you know, this, it's data, right? But ultimately, you know, it's a function of, you know, the kinds of problems we're trying to solve, right? You know, 5 years ago when we were talking about intelligence, it was really about AI as data science. How do we get some kind of insight or decision intelligence? Now we're actually trying to automate things in a way that is real time. And so, you know, when we talk about data quality, people talk about data governance and structure. I think, you know, we've added the dimension of time. If you think about it, like you have real-time systems that are feeding data as it is happening, trying to mesh with legacy systems that batch once a day. That's like having a phone call with a newspaper, right? It just doesn't work. And so, you know, data is getting these new dimensions to it that you go, well, I want to clean up the data. If your system is not a real-time system, you're never going to make that data mesh with systems that are operating, making decisions, actioning, and getting feedback in real time. So I think context is a great word. I think context, and I think there's the symmetry, right? As we understand the way that AI processes data and makes decisions, I think also the way that we look at our architecture in this problem, you see the same exact kind of template and fact pattern play out. Mm-hmm. As we understand the context of how AI is used, we understand that there are more pieces than just data. Yeah. And I think as you move out in rings, systems of the next ring.
So it sounds to me like in many ways, this isn't really a this or that. It's just the deeper we get into actually retrofitting our enterprises for AI, it's more like this is the next challenge that we come up to. It is an inevitable hit point and barrier. I would love if you guys could make it maybe even a little bit more crisp for our listeners. My guess is that many will be recognizing some of the issues that they've dealt with already in the conversation. Mm-hmm. But for those who are just trying to wrap their mind around this, what does a systems issue like this look like in practice? Or what's something that you've seen where this actually has stopped AI from progressing and doing what people hoped it would do?
I can give you a great example. For us, pricing is really complex. We have nearly 2 trillion with a T prices in our price cube. The system that does that is, again, it's a 24-hour batch system. It updates itself daily in a giant job that runs overnight. If we want to get to where we can take all of the available facts dynamically and understand what the best available cost and price is for a customer at a point in time, that 24-hour updating system is never going to be able to do that, right? We're never going to be able to process real-time information and actually use agentic intelligence. And so we have to rebuild that in a way that is real time, that can take advantage of information that is kind of flowing in and streaming in order to be able to take advantage of that. And, you know, you go, well, why? Well, it's a 30-year-old piece of technology, right? Like these ideas did not exist when some of this technology we're trying to junction it into was built.
Yeah. And to give another example, we see a lot with our supply chain resilience challenges where the boundary of what an organization is able actually to reach out to, right? So this can be third parties, the actual supply data. Trying to pull that through requires collaboration around data engineering and software engineering. So you not only have the challenge of the internal organization having very dated systems, they're not on the same ERP system as everyone else, or they have 16 different ERP systems from mergers and acquisitions, et cetera, and they're trying to bring that all together, some of which can be upgraded, some cannot. But then you have critical data products that are required in order to build a contemporary solution. And you cannot get, you have only limited influence on what you can get those third parties to do, right? They may not be willing to integrate completely. They may have, obviously, system restrictions that they physically can't. Not everyone has everything on the cloud. So, like, especially when we see a multi-cloud, very complex integration plane and significant IT estates that are still on-premise, it's physically impossible to get everyone to that near real-time, fully integrated situation in order to effectively build a new solution or migrate a solution. So I think that's an inhibitor right now. It's a very real scenario where you have multiple parties and the client customer doesn't have full control over all the decisioning on what architectural pattern, what actual capability will be enabled, and the readiness and maturity of who they're interacting with, right? It's not as simple as it being a single source system. And I think that's really where, and one of the topics I'm sure will come up today is, you know, where ontologies and digital twins of business processes are really coming to the forefront. Because then the business is more heavily involved in making priorities focused on, okay, we know we have to modernize this one piece. And if we do that, it will unlock the ability for us to complete a migration or complete a modernization that can have an agentic solution that's even feasible.
I totally agree, Danielle. I think that kind of systems thinking approach, truly understanding the breadth and then being able to identify and focus in the right places, I think probably half of the tears shed right now over like AI gone wrong is failure at that kind of first initial question to pick the right places to play and to really focus there.
One of the other components that I think is a huge area of interest is when the decisions are made about systems modernization or any blockers, is most organizations are not doing value scoring. They're not able to fully prioritize which system waves and modernization are going to happen to support AI, ML, and Gen AI use cases. And so we see a need for a much more quantitative approach to determine where am I investing my time and people and keeping the lights on, running the business, operations? Where am I investing in application modernization and hopefully using Gen AI as much as possible? And where am I building new things? They have limited resources. And so to do some value scoring around what is the lift, what is the outcome I'm expecting by making these investments often helps those priorities become much clearer. And so I think the lack of prioritization is a blocker, in short.
Have you found this conversation shifting? There's all sorts of reasons why you can understand that an organization would be hesitant to go whole hog into changing all of these systems. Many of them are mission critical. Many of them have been working for a long time. Has the discourse changed at all? And I guess maybe to add a layer to it, in what way, if any, is the agentic era of AI changing the conversation?
I think it is changing. I think what's possible has changed in scope very substantially. And not to open the how much can truly be automated and some of the really outlandish headlines that are out there, but I think most enterprises are seeing that there are step functions available and efficiency and performance and quality that can be unlocked if you can actually stand these capabilities up successfully. And so it really does provoke a question. I think a lot of organizations are getting more sophisticated at understanding their business architecture, right? What are our processes, our patterns? How does product, money, customer relationships flow through our organization? Where are the places where we have big opportunities? And then being able to overlay that in their technology and data architecture to, like Danielle's saying, prioritize and go, what are the key unlock points for us where the big value opportunities in our business can be released? And so whether that's a pricing thing, a customer service thing, a supply chain resilience thing, you start to understand what are the key things which need to be unlocked in order to do that. And that shifts it from the modernize your IT, like eat your vegetables, like it sounds like a good thing to do, but like if I don't do it today, everyone lives, to being very outcome oriented. There's a specific outcome I'm trying to unlock. There are a very tangible set of things which need to be invested in and changed in order to do that. And there's a very clear path that you can test, results measure, and ultimately hold accountable for value delivery, which I'm not sure was super clear, at least in my experience. Even 3 or 4 years ago, it was much more of an abstract, like we know the value is there. Mm-hmm. We don't exactly know the map to get it. I think that playbook has gotten a lot better defined in the last couple of years.
Yeah. The way that we describe it is, what is the contemporary interaction model or operating model that needs to be in play for a Gen AI enabled enterprise? The very first thing is finally solving this communication gap that exists largely between business stakeholders and technology teams. It's a tale as old as time. It used to be dubbed a governance problem, a data ownership problem. But now I think the interaction model has to accommodate a lot of things. IT running well and using Gen AI to improve the business of IT, to advance modernization of all types, infrastructure, data center exits, applications, software development lifecycle, data engineering, all the things, but also serving the business. The business now is accustomed to new interfaces. They're using ChatGPT, they're using Claude in their own personal lives, and they expect to have improved experiences in the office, right? Whether it's front, middle, or back office. So the pressure on IT is to move closer to the business, understand it more, advance the opportunity to score projects together, determine the highest value pools, you know, that they want to focus on, and also really moving more ownership of some of, you know, business-led, IT-enabled is the statement that's most often heard now, bringing the business closer to those decisions, and frankly, compressing the entire portfolio of very duplicative application capability and analytics. Like, we all know there are applications that do the same thing. Like, why are there 16 applications that do this one thing? Let's use an agentic experience and Gen AI, you know, capability to figure out we have duplicative, you know, functionality here. We don't need 16 APIs that are connecting system A to system B. I think the efficiency that comes with that, and when the business is putting those ideas out front and being open about how they're consuming data, how they're consuming their day-to-day decisioning, really lets you see, okay, what should we be deduplicating? How do we make people more efficient just by simplifying the technical landscape, but also making sure that the business feels like they're getting the attention they need and that IT isn't spending all the time tinkering and, you know, trying to just fix IT. It's to fit, you know, to serve the business. And I think that's the important part of the conversation that's coming about, and then quantifying it. It is not a coincidence that the majority of our data modernization and AI strategy and design and delivery engagements are now coming from the office of the CFO. And I think you're really seeing people expect that there's a bottom line, that there's a number, that there's an understanding of that value, as I brought up before, particularly since the business is the one that can quantify that. They have the ability and the context to say, I have 16 analysts doing X, Y, and Z. This is how the business process needs to run. And ideate about the actual impact to the workforce or to operational efficiency with the math, doing the math on that to show that as a powerful business case.
I started my career at Amazon that made me a believer in kind of the product and platform architecture. And there have been some interesting examples where traditional businesses have adopted this, right? Goldman Sachs, quite famously, only hires traders who can code Python at this point, right? Their expectation is that there is a level of technical proficiency in their business people. But that's not the mainstream. And I think this idea that IT is focused on engineering very powerful platforms and that building products on those becomes a business exercise, and you can democratize that to kind of technology-enabled business teams, and that is a massive thing to accelerate and scale value. That was a really nice story that I don't think was accessible to most traditional businesses. Mm-hmm. I think if you looked inside, you know, leading tech companies, you would see that. A few exceptions, but mostly not in traditional business. I think that the before agentic, the low code, no code technology was extremely limited, right? It wasn't enough to really make a difference. I think the tools are getting good enough now where we are starting to see that model become accessible to a much broader range of enterprises, where you don't have to completely retool your entire workforce, get a completely different talent model. The business experts you have with these new tools can actually, on a well-engineered platform, start to build really value-additive products quickly. And I think that's where this idea of, you know, like, what does scale look like? You know, was it 2 years ago, the like, you know, let 1,000 flowers bloom, like nobody ever fully understood what that meant. I think we're starting to get this idea that you can, you know, with the right architecture and the right operating model, really start to democratize technology production, product production now, in a way where business teams, and the office of the CFO is a great example, right? I think there we're seeing in our own four walls, they're starting to build products now. And like, as a technology team, we love that, right? Like, as much as we can empower them to do, we want the platform to make that accessible, scalable, to handle data and integration, but like value delivery, no one knows better than they do. Marketing is another one we're seeing a tremendous amount of energy and acceleration come out of. And I think we'll continue to see this scale, but I do think the tools have been really instrumental in making this kind of concept that has been nice sounding for a long time really, really activate and become powerful.
Yeah, both of you were speaking to this, but I think it's worth putting a fine point on that. Effectively, you're saying that agents are both the reasons, but also the mechanism increasingly for the sort of modernization project. And I think maybe in the spirit of keeping it crisp, how does an AI or agentic, especially accelerated modernization project differ from what people might have in their minds from systems modernization in the past?
Sure, I can answer that. I mean, to me, there are five things that are critical if we're talking about using agentic capability and generative AI to modernize an application. Let's say it's a legacy application in a data center. Maybe half the people know what it does, half don't. The first one is logic extraction, right? The expectation is it extracts the logic to understand what the application is actually doing. Second thing, it must convert the code. That's an expectation, right? If it doesn't convert the code, it's not really super useful. And it should be able to convert that code into something where you're actually identifying the target of what you want to convert it to. So you need to have optionality to say, convert X to Y, Z, et cetera. The third thing is documentation. It should fully explain in human readable terms and in business context. There is no comments anywhere in the application. Let's document what it's actually doing. So that can be considered to be a reverse engineering for people to understand contextually the context of the application. It should be generating test data and test cases. Obviously, with the use of synthetic data generation, this is extremely valuable. And that's an existing generative AI technology that was available before ChatGPT. So I would say that's an important part. That's an expectation we would have. And then I would say, continuous testing and remediation and a feedback loop for whoever is modernizing the application. So a software engineer, it is assisting them with all of those things. It also, on the side, that's very code heavy, what I just described, but it should be doing a common data model. It should be giving the schema, you know, obviously any ingress and egress, if the application's calling APIs, whatever its dependencies are on either side, right? Before and after it does its function. The data footprint of that. And so that data discovery piece is also essential. So that would be my kind of bill of materials of what I would expect in a code assistive tool.
I think that was a extremely well explained analysis. The thing that jumps out to me, like if I were to crisply explain what feels and looks different, the composition of the team will be the first thing you notice. Mm-hmm. It's much more business people than engineering people. What they do is different. The engineering people are there much more in kind of a coaching or consultative capacity. Hey, this is what you can do and this is what you can't do. They're not the ones actually sitting there assembling, building, you know, they're not sitting there with console open, pounding out code. The speed at which you get to a prototype, in my experience, is hours to days, right? And then there's something really different about what an MVP means when it is the actual business team using it that has fashioned it, and their ability to understand, refine, and mature that looks really different in this like long cycle, 2-week sprint. You know, you have five people between the person who drives the car and builds the car, intermediating the message. It doesn't look anything like that, right? It is very much hands-on, business expert driven. And, you know, really, I think the unlock for that is having sound platforms and that kind of basic understanding of architecture. And, you know, where you do that in just one little corner of a business and your business people see that this is not like a fantasy anymore. This is actually a thing that can happen. To your previous question, Nathaniel, I think seeing this alive in your own organization reframes how you think about projects to invest in enabling this to be done more broadly.
And I think the trust that's necessary, right? So using a small pilot that everyone knows, right? We always encourage our clients to pick something that has what we call a wide impact radius. Pick an application that everyone knows. Pick an application or data products that go with that application or come out of that application as your test bed, as a pilot. And the adoption of it and the support that people have and the trust that people will have for the outcome of the modernization is significantly higher. You definitely have to bring people on the journey. I love what you said, Ellery, around the kind of the business-centric focus. And also, they don't know what the outcome can look like. So having a prototype, having an MVP is really important to make sure that you're validating what you heard from the input, that feedback loop. The human in the loop in this is absolutely essential, of course.
So I think that there are lots of nuggets that you guys have dropped throughout this that effectively come back to what organizations who are doing this well are doing in terms of where it's located in the organization, in terms of how they're thinking about getting started. But my guess is that there are a lot of folks listening who are feeling very behind and are trying to figure out where to start. And so if you had to give someone advice for how to either shift their thinking about this or get started in the immediate term, not after some big long process, but in the immediate term, what might you say?
I might steal something Danielle brought up earlier, which is to kind of take a little bit of a scoring approach. And I do think, you know, there's just something hugely important about getting the early wins and like building belief. I mean, our CEO says, go make believers out of people, right? And I've been on, I think, 5 digital transformations at different companies, and they never fail because technology, they fail because people lose faith, right? They lose the plot. You go and find the nexus point of where is the team the most ready? Where do you have the right kind of curiosity mindset? Different business teams are in different places, right? They'll have different personalities and characters. Some are more skeptical. Some are more experimental. You want to find the experimental team. The one that's already tinkering with stuff, even if they don't know about these tools yet. You want where the technology is closer and more malleable. If you have a platform in place that's relatively sophisticated and mature, there's a Salesforce or a Manhattan or something like that's highly extensible, that's easy to build on. I think that's an awesome accelerator. And that, you know, is kind of the second leg. And then I think the third leg is really, where do you think that you have done the most to mature the necessary supporting capabilities? And so that's where I think engineering does come in, right? Are your systems aligned in terms of their recency? Are you dealing with contention between real time and not real time? Can you easily connect the different things necessary to activate value in the business process? And in some places you'll find, no, there's some massive obstacle. I can't get around this thing that is central to getting value out of here. Don't go there, right? Where there's nothing immovable in your path. That looks like a great place to start. And so as much as you can find goodness in those three axes, I think that gives you a great indicator of where you have high probability of success. I think the success you have once then will engender curiosity and confidence to go do that again and again, and will build confidence in your organization ultimately to make the investments necessary to, you know, kind of remove some of those obstacles that may have blocked you in other areas. But also teams that come from a more skeptical place, as they see their peers succeeding at this, they will become more curious and open as well. This will be less of taking a flyer and more of, hey, we've done this repeatedly well. Like, why would we not jump into this? And so it kind of spreads organically. But I really do think the place to start is the place you have the highest probability of success, because this, you know, it spreads, right? Like, it's like you plant it and you find a place where if you can get it to grow through one season, the next season there's more and more and more.
Yeah, for us, we generally would say an internal activation program is essential. One of the things that we often recommend to organizations that are in the crawl or walk stage of modernizing, rolling out Gen AI agents, whatever the experience may be, is to do an internal activation program. And we encourage them to think and act like a software company, because they are rolling out software. And it's not just software that people are fully comfortable with. It is asking them to operate differently. And so there's a little bit of this, I call it range anxiety, where will this impact my job in a negative way? I don't understand what's coming. I'm not sure how to use the tool. So an internal activation program works at any level of maturity. And it includes a couple things. One, participation in a pilot or being brought along on the journey of the very first business area or program that's going to launch with the new capability. It includes an education pathway. It includes gamification. People are inherently competitive. How do you incentivize people? Perhaps there are hackathons or there's an expo or a lab where people can actually interact with some of the new technology before it comes to their area. So a launch program and campaigns and really forward deployed engineers is the most popular thing ever now, right? How do you have people that are kind of these activation leads to get people comfortable to solicit new ideas? The presence of technology does not equal success. Adoption does. And I think really looking at adoption, looking at usage, not only initial usage, but continued usage, and having things that engage people across different lines of business is one of the most powerful ways to get these programs really rolling.
Well, this is an awesome conversation. I think I spend a lot of time across the spectrum of different, let's call them leverage points in when it comes to AI in the enterprise. And this is one of those areas that I just think has so much leverage if people can think about it the right way and start to chip away at it rather than just be overwhelmed by the seeming hugeness of it. So appreciate both of you sharing insights on how to make that a little bit more approachable, and excited to see how things evolve over the coming months.